first?
It's a question, but it might involve a little bit more than a question, if you can shut me up now.
Okay.
I would first like to ask, do you think that The Ragged Child of Salent is a political tract or a novel? It's a very good novel, but I don't think that Newland was a professional novelist. And I don't think he had not worked in Hastings for a year, the novel, he would never have written it, and he would never have written a novel himself. As far as I know, he never wrote anything else. And the history of Newland seems to be very vague. I heard he was Irish. I don't know if you could check up on that. So that's the first one. Do you believe it's a political novel or a tract? A novel or a political tract? I think it's a political tract, a very good novel, secondary. The second, I'd just like to go back to the lunch hour and the dinner hour. In the working world agreement for the building industry, it's still referred to as the dinner period. And when I used to call it lunch, all my friends, I went into the building industry in 1940. There was a lot of people of Newland's age around at that time, and I was always called, I was going pot if I called it the lunch break. And I still refer to it as the dinner break, and I'm rather sorry that you made the difference.
Yes, well, when I'm in Rome, I do as the Romans do. And when I was in the building game, you're right, it was the dinner break. I said earlier that I didn't think it could be classed as a political tract because it's not phrased in the way that a political tract would be. It's obvious that Robert Newland put an enormous amount of effort in trying to make it entertaining because there are jokes, there's witticism, there's funny cross talk, there's behind the hand comment, and the arguments are sort of presented obliquely, so I would say that it, in no way could it be categorised as a political tract. As far as I know, you're right, he didn't write anything else, and therefore all the more glory and praise and appreciation of the fact that for somebody who wasn't a writer, and as far as I know, had no training in writing, and worked at all sorts of different jobs around the world and all that, but was educated enough to know, when it should be a full stop or a semicolon, and English grammatical structure, and knew enough about that to set himself this task. And I mean, it's a bloody thick book, it's how many pages? And so, it's 584 pages here. And so although you should never judge the merit of a book, a novel, or anything else on how difficult it was for the author to produce it, to write it, you have to use other criteria. But nevertheless, in view of his background and the fact that he wasn't a novelist and didn't sort of educate himself or progress in writing at all, but launched into this as a one-off, you've got to say, well, for that period and for that person, it's an absolutely fantastic effort. I mean, bloody hell, who would have expected such a thing to have happened and to have turned out as well as it has? I mean, the fact that millions of people have read this when they might not have read any other political novel. Millions have been to the play, various versions of the stage performance, where they might never have gone to a political play before or since. It has that kind of approachable feel about it, and I think for that, it's worthy of the status that it has.
Thank you. At the back.
Yeah, just in a bit about subsidising books. I think I remember over my period, I must have subsidised The Ragged Child of Philanthropist, because it's the sort of book you lend to somebody, you never see it.
Right.
I'm going to stick my neck out because I come a bit late, so forgive me if I'm wrong. And it's kind of a selfish question, because I come from a background where everybody read it, even if they stole it. How many people here have read it? This is a purely selfish question, if I'm not intruding upon your...
Go ahead, yeah.
How many people here...
Put your hand up if you've read it.
I knew I had nothing new to say.
Oh, dear.
Well,
is it known what his... when I read it, I wondered about this. Is it known what his political affiliations were, and also whether perhaps he had, as it seemed he had, read Marx? Or known of Marx?
My own impression is that first of all, the Labour Party have taken over this in a sense and claim that he's talking about their brand of socialism. A lot of Labour Party people recommend it and speak about it as if it belonged to them. But I think that's a sneaky, deliberate attempt on their part to hijack it. But from what the economics that it contains, the descriptions and explanations, I would say, I don't know for sure, perhaps Montgomery Coleman may know about the facts about this, but from what is contained in this, I would say he must have read Marx, or a popularized version of Marxian economics. He must have known about that, because the clarity and accuracy of the theoretical stuff is so spot on. But I mean, I don't know whether anybody...
Well, he did. Just to answer a couple of biographical questions that have been asked, in the front row it says, where was he? He was Irish, and he spoke with a sort of an Irish lilt to his voice all through his life. And he was a member of the SDF, Social Democratic Federation, which was the first Marxist organisation in Britain, formed in 1883, but which adopted a specifically socialist programme after that. And he will have read, in the SDF, they didn't generally read Marx's own writings. In fact, I don't know how many of you know or would be interested in it, but the SDF was led by a man called Hindman. I use the word led advisedly, because he was an arrogant leader, and he dominated the organisation. And he'd been educated at Eton Public School, incidentally, and he was a man who thought that the working class were only good to follow him, although he's very often regarded as someone who first popularised Marxist ideas in Britain. There's a great deal to be said against Hindman. Now, I won't get into that, but one of the things that happened in relation to Hindman and the SDF was that they banned the sale of Marx's literature inside the SDF on the grounds they didn't want to be associated with foreign material. And they thought that if it was written by Marx, it would put workers off. Hindman wrote his own version of Das Kapital, a very poor version, which was called England for All, in which he attempted to take some of Marx's ideas. And Marx, incidentally, criticised him for this, for Marx was aware of Hindman's misuse of his the failure to acknowledge him in relation to this. And incidentally, had one meeting with Hindman, where he went to Hindman's house and said Hindman's wife seemed to be a very pleasant person, but Hindman was arrogant and unpleasant. But the important point about it was that the people who joined the SDF, like Noonan, and certainly did join the SDF, they would have come across Marxist ideas from that impossibilist group, what the people who were called the impossibilists within the SDF at the end of the last century, the 1890s, beginning of the 20th century, who were subsequently expelled for running economics classes, teaching Marx's basic ideas and so on. People like his fellow Irishman Jack Fitzgerald, who was expelled and subsequently was a founder of the SPGB. Now, whether Noonan knew Jack Fitzgerald, I don't know. That research is yet to be done. But that gives you a bit of background about it. I can go into more background, but that's not the moment to do it. Next question.
It's clear from my reading of it that Noonan Trestle had a clear understanding of the source of the problems for the workers, the wage system, exploitation of wage labour, and money system. But didn't he propose a whole series of nationalisation measures which would, at least he claimed, work toward a solution for the working class? And isn't the Socialist Party's case that nationalisation is not a solution and does not lead to a solution for the workers?
That brings us to the matter of whether even if we agree the analysis is correct, the spread of the solution is appropriate. And in you're quite right to raise the point that in the event it seems that Robert Noonan was so concerned to improve the conditions, you know, in the meantime, the old in the meantime approach, that he was advocating that kind of policy. And that's probably why the Labour Party could have tried to have hijacked it, talking about their policies. Although, really, that's an insult to Trestle for them to do that, because whilst he might have concluded that the possibility of socialism, he understood what socialism was. I think he knew that nationalisation wasn't socialism, but that conditions were so bad and they're not likely to get any better until there was some social, improvement in social conditions and the life of people, and through something like the Labour Party or ILP or something, that there could be such improvements, and nationalisation is part of that. But we have to fault him on his, I might say, failure to grasp the method. I think he had grasped the method, but realised that it was, or thought that it was a long way off. And so there were these immediate programmes of reform and nationalisation and get a Labour government or something like that to make things better. Although that's not our approach, you can understand somebody thinking along those lines, because as somebody once said, or probably a lot of people have said, you're not likely to persuade an empty belly. You know, somebody who's the immediate and medium term concern is to get some food and warmth and that. It's difficult circumstances. So there's some justification, I think, for people like Trestle and others saying, get them bloody fit enough to have time to sit back and listen and read about socialism. I don't know whether others agree with me, but I think we knew what socialism was, and it coincided with what we say socialism is, but that he felt, held back from making that an immediate demand as we do. We say, bugger the meantime. During the meantime, people are dying, wars are taking place, exploitation, pollution. In the bloody meantime, we want socialism now. And that's the only way to approach it. Because if you don't approach it that way, you perpetuate the bloody meantime forever. But I don't think he saw that. I don't know, I get that feeling.
Okay, you've got a lot of questions, let's try and get through them. One at the back there. Yeah.
Sorry, come on, I don't know if you brought in, I think
I'll point you to the person in front of you.
Yeah. All right, two brief points, hopefully, that I wanted to raise about this level. First is what Nez has partly mentioned already, the humorous side of it. Particularly, I've got in mind the names of some of the characters. Humour, I think, always helps make a book more readable, more attractive, perhaps to a wider readership. Names that spring to mind, I think, are Sir Gravel in Closeland, one of the large landowners, I think, perhaps the Tory candidate in the local election. Or people like Belcher, the picker, and Grinder, the grocer, not only humour, but also giving the reader some idea of the character before Noonan goes on to describe their character in more detail. So that's one aspect. And the other aspect, there's, I think, already mentioned about the relevance of the book today. Well, even though it was written at the beginning of the century, a lot of conditions for a working class are very much the same today as they was at the turn of the century, apart from superficial advances in technology. And apart from the conditions, also the attitude, the daily obscurer, you've got the Sun and virtually all of the rest of the press, the equivalent of that. And people's ideas, people's perceptions of the working class of their position. Now, you can't change society because it's against human nature. That's what people like Crass was saying when Frank Owen starts talking about change society. Well, how many people who are not aware of socialism would say that today? A very large proportion of them. And people who want to change society look upon them as being troublemakers and agitators. I think that's probably largely the case today. So I think, you know, the humour is very attractive, and also it's relevant today as well as before.
Thank you very much. Would you like to come on? Did you have it?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. It's a long time since I read the book. Quite a long time actually. Every day at work, I hear people saying if only they had more money, they could have this and they could have that, a new car, better house. They say this is the way to being happier. To try and confront them and tell you, no, it's not more money you want, it's actually no money. It's very difficult, and you know, sometimes people look at your scans. Is there anywhere in the book that refers to the abolition of money?
That's right. That's where Crass, where all the others join in with Crass. Well, he really must be stark raving mad. It's the occasion when there's a total agreement among all of them, including the poor little labourer boy, who hardly gets a word in at all. Because, you know, that he does deal with that, that's right. You know, you don't want more higher wages. Threepence an hour more. What you want is, what we need is more without money. He does deal with that,
You touched briefly on, we talked quite a lot about the abject poverty of in the case of Russell Novel, which, of course, people in the building industry, they don't have. But one thing they do have, and you did touch on this briefly, is that I think I'm right in saying that today the industrial accident rate is higher in the building industry than in any other. I'd be interested to know if that was also the case in Circle State. The other difficulty he didn't have, which we, or more of us, have today, was at least he was able to have put his social arguments in the lunch break or the dinner break. I mean, I'm a worker who had a lunch break instead, and the people I work with, I can't talk to them at lunch break or dinner break. I mean, they plug into their computers and their computer games, you know, monkeys throwing explosive bananas at each other and this kind of thing. This is what goes on in the lunch break. I mean, I have to save most of the arguments for the boss's time. Yeah. I mean, fortunately, it doesn't matter too much because most of them were with the boss. But I'd like to know whether, you know, the industrial accident rate was as high in those days as it is now, in that trade.
I don't have the statistics, but I should imagine that, I do recall an article in the Standard some years back which touched on accidents at work, and it mentioned that the mining industry and the building industry, right up until the post-Second World War, was where most accidental deaths and serious injuries occurred. That was right up until the late 1950s. 1950s, so it was still going on, and I believe today the health and safety executive produce annual reports, and I believe you will find that whereas the proportion of fatal accidents in the mining industry has fallen because there's less miners and more mines have been closed down, the percentage of those at work in the building industry is the same percentage of the number employed, because there are less employed than there used to be, and there's mass unemployment among building workers. But percentage-wise, it's the same percentage annually as it was at the turn of the century. So nothing, you know, on a percentage base, nothing has improved or changed there. It's all rush. It's all, we're losing money on this job. We've got to get a move on. It's all, you don't need a safety, a tow board or scaffolding, or it's all, you know, we've got to get out of it. You know, I've got the clerk to work to the boss on. It's all the way down the line. He's got his boss on his back, and blah, blah, blah. And everybody's trying to protect their job and carry favour or at least.
Those holes and crevices are not deep enough, don't require putty or filling, just paint. Put extra paint in the holes and nobody will notice. Use plenty of miterine, as we used to say. I don't know whether they use that phrase, but when I was in the game, we used a lot of miterine. That's putty that goes into a hole where the joint doesn't fit properly. And all that sort of thing. This is typical today. If you ask any building worker, scrimping, scraping, making a cheap job where a good job would be, or sometimes, from an economic point of view, it doesn't pay. If I need an anecdote in a minute before we go, I'll tell you the one about the concrete floor that was poured at 7 degrees below freezing. Anyway,
right, and we've got back there.
Yeah.
You know, when I vouch for like what Les was saying there, because I spent 25 years in the building game, and most of that was in London. But and in fact, when I read the book, I found in fact that things hadn't changed all that much. Like, you know, the conditions of at the time I read it, which was in the mid 70s, and that time we were sort of like, you know, heavy into trade union activity, and of course that was, you know, there was plenty of that about at the time, and of course like the economic situation was different then, but the conditions, in fact, that the employer was expecting them to put people into at that particular time, I don't know what it's like now, because I've sort of partly left it, but partly ended as well, by doing different people. But things, and I noticed that things haven't changed, but the thing about, what I wanted to talk about was the ironic thing about what I read in when I first read the book, I wanted to get hold of if there was anything on Noonan himself. And I searched around and I found a biography by a fellow called T.H. Bull. And that was interesting because in that book, again, they talked about how this work became published. And apparently, when Noonan was dying on his deathbed, he sort of left this sort of manuscript to his daughter, his one and only daughter, I think. And she was under the bed where he died or wherever, at home. And apparently afterwards she was working in some one of these fancy tea rooms where the rich ladies would come to sort of have their afternoon tea or whatever. And she overheard him talking about books. And of course she mentioned the fact that she had this book under the bed at home. And of course, like, you know, brought it in. And I think something like, you know, they give her a half a crown for the book. And then they had this sort of like the royalties go to them or whoever. That's the ironic thing about it, like the whole sort of thing, which made me think, like, you know, that things haven't actually changed. Yeah. Even the philanthropists have been ripped off, you know, left, right, etc.
Yeah. We've got a few more, so we can
Yeah. Points raised by a contributor earlier on about the humour of the book reminded me of a problem of an acquaintance of mine who's Turkish, who has a magnificent knowledge of English, and he was so impressed by the Ragged Trousers that he devoted a lot of time to making a translation. It would be enormously valuable to readers in Turkey, and he abandoned the task halfway through. And one of his greatest difficulties was this problem of trying to translate into a Turkish equivalent names that in the novel had a definite meaning.
Yeah.
But the whole thing became too much for him, and it's an interesting problem how you translate
what
works
about
like
that. The idiomatic way of speaking, yes, the working class way of,
that's right,
mispronouncing
so many ways. He could understand it because his English was excellent.
Yeah.
He'd been here some years, but he when he tried to translate it became too much. But this particular person came to it from a Leninist background. And although you made particular reference to the way the Labour Party had appropriated this book, I must say for most of the years I more particularly identify it with the Communist Party. It was
virtually required reading and so forth. And it does strike me as something of a contradiction that they attach so much importance to something which spelled out the labour theory of value, which was the aspect of the socialist case that we found CP as least likely to be happy about. But I don't know whether you have any comments on the way in which CP has read it and understood it and what they got from it or what they didn't get from it.
Well, now come to think of it, the first time I read it was when I was in the YCL, the Young Communist League, which I was in my innocent, naive youth, until the age of, I think, about 17 or 18. And I think it was when I was in the YCL and we had these, what I now recognise as indoctrination sessions. And that's when it was recommended. And, you know, I read it and enjoyed it then. And I've read it since. You could be right. I'd forgotten or hadn't realised that the CP wouldn't mind Noonan's conclusions and proposals about nationalisation and the state being the benefactor or what it could be, and because the CP would go along with that and would ignore perhaps the Marxian theoretical stuff that undermined their concepts of wealth and distribution of it. Yes, it's an interesting point.
Hello, back there.
It does say that in one part of the book that the time will come when the screw gets tightened on the masses by the bosses and they'll rise up and drown the oppressors in their system in sea of blood. In the light of 14 years of this government, the new laws that are being passed, the last budget, for example, does your party see this a Marxian same thing? Does your party see this time coming?
When the pressure will be even greater and workers will screw down even tighter.
Yeah. We're 100 years on. Nothing's changed. It's the wage slaves.
Well, it's hard to predict the future. What has changed is that the socialist ideas, socialist propositions, socialist analysis remain as virile and applicable and relevant now as they were then, in spite of all the attempts to brush it away into the 19th century history, a footnote to the 19th century history books, in spite of all attempts to do that, at school, in church, in the media, everywhere, it's still a proposition which they cannot face up to. Given the chance, they slink away with their tails between their legs whenever they confront us or other socialists. I'm talking about real socialists. So in that sense, the idea is still alive and kicking and virile and positive and offering hope and opportunity. So in that sense, that's one thing. But also, what the system does to the workers depends not only upon the ideas that workers have, but upon the vicissitudes of the economic social system itself. It's difficult to say what would be in the interest of the owning class. Sometimes it's in their interest to throw a few crumbs. Sometimes it's in their interest when their rate of profit is falling or, there's a recession, to chuck the workers on the scrap heap and screw them down and cut welfare benefits and all that. This is like the ongoing effect that capitalism has, and it's difficult to forecast. All we can say with certainty, and other members perhaps could go into this a bit more deeply, because I'm suddenly cognizant of the fact that I didn't speak about socialism very much. Perhaps that's an omission that might be remedied if we've got time by other members. But all I can say is that what we can guarantee without any equivocation or doubt at all is that so long as capitalism lasts,
things will happen to the working class which are bad, which are deleterious to their health, which are which prevent ordinary people fulfilling their potential. We know that. It could be awful exploitation, being killed in a war, or it could be not so awful exploitation, just being killed at work. But, I mean, it's one or the other. It could be you can afford a telly, and next month you've got to give it back to the rental, the higher rental people, because you can't afford it. But it's all up and down on a permanent baseline of exploitation, deprivation, anxiety, fear, alienation, powerlessness, and all that. And if you stress that, plus the positive possibility of the alternative world society, there's got to be some bells have got to ring somewhere, and that's what we hope to do. But whether, you know, who knows whether capitalism's going to get, from the workers' point of view, going to get marginally better or marginally worse, I don't know. But I hate it well, put it this way. If you could describe capitalism at its best, full employment, no world recession, high production, councils subsidising the rents, children having a good education, health service restored to its 1945, you know, blah, blah, blah. If you could describe all that, I would still say it stinks. Yeah. It's intolerable. Because behind all that is the degradation and exploitation of men and women who deserve better and can get better if they work at it.
Right, we've got time for some more questions and points from people.
Just one little thing. I mean, this question about industrial accidents and this question of the millennium and the time being. I mean, they died of bloody lead poisoning, that's for sure, but they didn't even know about it. And to bring in this question about in the meantime, and I don't see that the meantime is opposed to the future, to the millennium, because... In point of fact, you know, the first time I ever read this book, it was a commercially published thing where somebody committed suicide at the end of it. And you've got to kind of give a bit of credit to the fellas in the building unions that they took up the banner and published it. And an awful lot of us wouldn't have read the damn book if the union hadn't published it. So I don't like this business. It sometimes seems to me there's a tendency to oppose the immediate to the millennium, and I think the two work together, because... at least we're sitting here. I doubt very much if you could sit in Owen's time, you'd be bloody well freezing, and and the lights would be out, and you'd be hungry. You know, so because people are what they are, things do move on. But I wouldn't oppose the two.
Is there anyone who hasn't spoken? I've got one other who has, but is there anyone who hasn't said anything and wants to say something? Sure, there is. Yes.
I think this book describes mainly to the so-called third world countries, especially in Africa, India, and Latin America, because they don't have trade unions. There are 8-10-year-old children working in the tea industry. The one we drink is, you know, Fertility or PG. It's all done by the trade unions, by the children, child labor. This book is more relevant anyway, not in the industrial West, but mainly to the third world. I think because the capitalism stinks throughout the world, whether in the West or East, whatever you describe it, I think that I'm very impressed by the book. Because I haven't read it. I had a quotation from many other people who read it, but I'm very glad to hear this book. I think capitalism is... It's not 100 years, it's still the 1994. Many people are dying in safety in Africa, and these people even haven't got any wages. They don't consider them as workers, because there is a description under class, whatever you call it. I think the whole problem is capitalism is working, you know. But the free minority in Africa are highly technologized, you know, they can communicate within the capitalist West, whatever they want. So the minority class, depriving the majority. So that's it. It's very unlimited. We have to look on the
front row. There was a program too on, this is to do with the building, played on mycotoxioma, a cancer of the lung, what you got from, of course, working with asbestos. Now, I was reading an American scientific journal, and of course there's things in the building trade where you don't need asbestos. But what this journal would not say is that thing would cost £200 or $500, and of course asbestos would only cost $100 or something. Now that's why asbestos got put in the building trade. It didn't, of course, it was safe or sound condition. It got simply because it was cheaper for that class to do. And you can read on Thompson and Newell, their stocks and shares have gone up in America and Britain and Australia.
That's a very interesting point. I was reading something about the same subject, and briefly, you know, most of the European and industrial countries, European countries, have dropped the use of asbestos because the known danger is so horrendous. They dare not. But because the amount of asbestos being bought and processed has fallen, the price has fallen. And so in those countries where they don't give a shit about the lungs of the workers, they're sawing, cutting, drilling and working on asbestos and putting it in flats and apartments and places like that. And lagging, it's said that a new factory has been opened in Pakistan, oil-based chemical works, and all the pipes, the hot pipes, are lagged with asbestos and because it's cheap, because the world price has dropped. So where knowledge and safety factors are brought in one country, the knock-on effect can be the opposite in some other country. I mean, it's, you know, there's no sympathy or concern for people's health at all. It's all to do with profitability.
Just two little bits here. First of all, regarding the accidents on so-called accidents on building sites. How much of it is the responsibility of the workers saying, look, I'm not going to do what you asked me to do because it's pretty unsafe?
I don't know.
And how much is it sort of like a deliberate... It is deliberate, really, isn't it? Is it an exaggeration to say these are murders? Because it's known that so these accidents could have been easily avoided if proper safety equipment and timely measures were followed. Deaths would have been avoided, etc. So, is it an exaggeration to say it's a murder?
No, I don't think it is an exaggeration. And the difference, as Tom was saying, that the 60s and 70s, there was a slightly different, there was relative full employment in the building industry. And you could dig your heels in. When I was ticket steward, equivalent of shop steward in those days, there were a few occasions when I said no. You know, we're not going to go up there unless there's proper scaffolding or something like that. It's too cold. It's too dangerous because it's too cold in midwinter when it's freezing, things like that. And you got away with that. You managed to persuade the clerk of the works, the general foreman, that, I don't want to push them too much. All right, then, well, I'll get the scaffolder in and we'll put up a bit of that house. But now, because of unemployment and all that, often... even where there is trade union representation and a ticket steward, they dare not push too much because, well, you know, you're scared or something? That's what they used to say. You're scared or what? Bugger off if you're afraid of heights. We can get somebody else in. Anyway, but it's not only the workers who suffer, it's the people who live in the places because there's... I mentioned this. You can't lay concrete when it's freezing because the ice... freezes and it stops the chemical transmutation. When you pour concrete, chemical processes have to take place and it requires heat. Below a certain temperature, those transformation processes don't take place. The stones and aggregate are not locked into position because the anyway. So below a certain temperature, it remains, it doesn't integrate. It's a slab with cement here, particles, and particles of sand and stone there, but they haven't locked together because it needs warmth to do it. And I remember a floor being laid in about 7 degrees below freezing, where when the people moved in, I mean about 18 months after the building was built, when the block was finished and the people, this is a council, needless to say, a block of council flats, so I don't think it would happen. Anyway, it was rushed. They tried to build fires underneath when it was being poured, underneath the steel plates, the shuttering, they built bonfires. And we're all saying, it's crazy, it won't do the trick, because it was so free, it was one of those winters, when February, when it dropped dreadfully, everything froze, and they're trying to keep it warm, and they said, it'll be all right. And cut a long story short, about 3 months after the people moved in, the bloody floor collapsed, and people went down. Furniture, pianos, television, children, the bloody lot. And one was killed, only one, which is very fortunate because the floor underneath held, because that had been poured when it was warmer. And I learned about this through the trade union journal, and I phoned up, or got in touch with the people that I'd worked with, and we were thinking of reporting the whole matter and explaining to somebody or other why it happened, but in the end, I think they got away with it. They just said it was a technical problem. So it's not, it means scrimping and scraping and trying to get out of a job as fast as possible can sometimes result in, and of course in other parts of Europe, buildings are collapsing all the bloody time because of the wrong mix. One part of cement to 150 parts of aggregate. And what do you expect? And all that. Where it says 4 1-inch rods, they put one in for the reinforced floor. And they're all falling down, India, Portugal, everywhere. I mean, it's so utterly ridiculous because it's inefficient.
We've got about a quarter of an hour. We've got a few questions that people want to ask over there.
I just wanted to mention that of all the industrial sort of the building industry or making machinery or things like that, it's all manner of things that harm, don't they? Whether it be the eyesight, the hearing, or the lungs and these sort of things. So it's not just people dying, it's people being physically damaged through industrial processes.
Yes.
And those aren't registered, but their lungs go for 60 years after, whatever, 20 years after they get cancer of the lungs or whatever it is. Or their eyesight goes for they're doing such fine work. Their hearing goes for working in such noisy conditions. So it's in the interest of us to try and make industrial processes do away so much noise and eyesight problems. And look at all those things, not just people pegging out on the job.
Maybe the Socialist Standard ought to publish every month a record of known accidents and deaths at work. It would be a very good thing, particularly given that when you talk about murder, there is a particular act called corporate manslaughter, that is a corporation killing someone. There has never in the history of British law been a successful prosecution under corporate manslaughter. But it so happens that the only person to have investigated corporate manslaughter in Britain is a member of this party, a fellow called Gary Snapper, who was in his party, who's made that his particular area of research. And he's researched it. In fact, right now he is on a tour of the country, going to coroner's courts, collecting the statistics on all of these cases where people have been murdered at work. And maybe we ought to be publishing those statistics every month, killed by capitalism. It's an idea, but there's no one else is publishing it, and it would make very vivid reading. And incidentally, just as a statistic, for those of you who don't know it, more people are killed in the construction industry in Britain every single year than were killed during the Falklands War. That's a very useful way of putting it. If you want to argue with anyone, you can tell them that. You think of all the people killed in the Falklands War, there are more on an average year in Britain, and it's going up at the moment because of deregulation. However, I'm abusing my role as chairperson. There is a question of that. You? Yeah.
Oh, just listening very rapidly to what you were saying.
I have to tell you to speak, it's not here.
Yeah.
Carry on asking questions.
The point which is allied to the war about the third world is that the anti-smoking lobby is congratulating itself on its success in the West. The tobacco industry is growing bigger and bigger smart simply because they've shifted from eastward and also to the third world. And many of the old universities, and I've had some of the old back in my films which were quite good storylines, but many of whose heroes and heroines were smoking all the time, have just been shunted out. And we put forth that together with the encouragement of the smoking amongst youth, which is done very discreetly. Really, the thing is rolling again.
And as a matter of fact, in Brazil, in city centres, the tobacco companies pay people to hand out cigarettes to children. This actually goes on all the time. You travel into South America, you see it in many countries. Behind you?
I'd just like to draw the attention of everyone here to, as it relates to this book and this talk, to an exhibition at the Festival Hall, photographs by a Brazilian photographer who was taken on the task of photographing people at work in different parts of the world, different conditions. And really, it's not for me to describe what there is there, but I can assure you that a visit there would open your eyes as to the unspeakable conditions in which human beings are working in many parts of the world today. So certainly in conditions which the workers that Kessel was dealing with, they themselves would have thought totally unacceptable, totally beyond the pale, as it were. Really, it's the most magnificent and graphic exhibition, which is well worth the while of everyone who don't know about this exhibition going and having a look at that.
No fee to get in. Yeah.
Can I just second that and say that the photographs that we delivered to Brazil, but there's much about this exhibition in India, and please, a lot more than half an hour or 45 minutes. There's a lot of material there.
Fantastic.
All
over the world.
And in the West.
And in
France.
And the conditions
of modern work.
At least.
Everyone should go there. So it's a royal festival. You can go next Sunday. You can't go next Sunday because you come here again. But you can go next Sunday. Right.
On this question of dangers at work, I did at one time work for a firm whose activities included demolition. Now, I wasn't involved in that side of it, but I had to go to meetings where managers in the demolition sphere of their activities were periodically hauled over the coals where the firm had been taken to court for infringement of safety regulations. And the managers would always say in mitigation that try as they would to get their people to wear the masks and so on, that they were fined for not wearing. They couldn't succeed. Now, I'm not putting this forward as an argument, as I have heard it put forward, to say, the workers want this dangerously, even though there are rules to prevent it. I know that they're working on overtime, and they found these safety measures slowed up the rate at which they could earn. So there were countervailing pressures. But it's worth bearing in mind that seems to be one of the problems in the area where there is legislation for safety, that the actual people concerned, not necessarily the owners, give it the slip.
Right.
Yeah. Going back to safety, I used to be a health and safety representative, and I used to go to courses on health and safety. And this, I'm talking about 10 years ago, and the health and safety executives come round and say that 80% of the accidents in the construction industry were preventable, provided the regulations had been obeyed or adhered to. And the trouble was that they weren't being. But when they did, you find an employer that was bad, and he was taken to court, even if he was proved guilty. The fine or the punishment was piffing to what? I mean, a man could be dead, he could be fined £2,000 or something there like that. And I would like to go just back to Les, when he was talking about the dinner break and he used to have these discussions. Well, I always remember being in the hut. There was always a big discussion went on during the dinner break. It was nearly all politics, and you usually found the Irish and the Scots were more left-wing than the Londoner, and the Irish always went, what's his name, the Irish socialist?
Connolly,
James Connolly. But there'd be a bigger tea, more than a tea break. I remember they tried to do away with the tea break, the morning and afternoon one, and they were working there, they were sort of trying to suppress the sort of subversive chat that was going on there during the break. But there used to be a period, if you was working outside and it rained, you used to get rain time, you had to sit in the hut for 2 hours, and then you could really have a discussion as long as this one is here today.
It was either that or discussing politics. So yeah. Game cards or discussing politics.
I must have been a better sight than you.
We'd like to thank you for a collection of £33.59. There's an opportunity. I know you've got another question. I'd like to remind you that we're back here not next Sunday, but the Sunday after. That on the 19th of January, you can come along to Camden Branch, where we're having a lecture on a brief history of Wave Stoke. You'll be made very welcome. But you can come on any Wednesday evening to the local branch. One of the things that comes out of this discussion is we're not simply here to talk about a novel and the past. We want to relate it to the present. We want to create a different sort of future. And that involves all of you getting involved. And that's what Owen was basically talking about, and everything else was pushed out of the way. He was trying to get people to react to it. I happen to think the reason The Ragged Trouser Philanthropist was such a great novel was because it was one of the few novels that dealt with one of the most common features of socialist life, and that was the frustration of getting across to people the socialist message. It's one of the few novels that really dealt with that with any sort of accuracy. And it has dealt with the fact that, I mean, Owen is not a heroic figure in many ways. I don't know whether you all recall, but at times he contemplated suicide. It wasn't a heroic thing, but he felt that way. The only time Owen stands on a public platform in the course of the novel, he's beaten up. One of the most moving parts of the novel, in my view, and everyone has their favourite bit of a classic like this, is the encounter with the renegade. You may remember Owen's friend, Barrington, during the election campaign, meets the speaker, who earlier on had been speaking on the socialist platform, which was attacked by the workers and threw a few stones at him. And the final stone hit him and left a scar above his eye. He nearly killed him, actually. Some weeks later, when the election campaign is on, Barrington is standing in the audience. He turns around to Owen and says, "I'm sure I recognise that guy out there with a scar on his forehead." And of course, this guy is the renegade, and the discussion that follows that is a very, very honest piece of writing by Newman. Because what the renegade says is, they are the working class, look around you, look at these people. Look at what they, if you want to make a revolution out of them, you've got some of them. You're going to be wasting your life, you'll be throwing pearls before swine. Well, this is something that every socialist thinks at some time. And that's why psychologically this is better than all the old novels of so-called socialist realism, you know, about the heroic workers organising strikes with big muscles and marching through the streets and taking things up. Because most of that stuff, anyone who really knows about the history of the working class struggle, it's a load of old bollocks, isn't it? It was romantic stuff largely written by people who were professional writers who invented a working class that would create socialism outside of the history that we've all experienced. Well, I'm saying all of that because I'm saying that whatever the frustration and the depression, and Christ knows I don't think there is any socialist here who hasn't experienced it, we do carry on, and the best way to carry on is to cooperate. If you stick together, you feel better. Work together towards a particular objective. And whatever that objective is, including running the meetings here today, so that we can help to educate each other, and everybody's taking a turn speaking at these meetings, whether it is coming along to the branch and helping us with this huge election campaign we're going in for in June, and if there is ever a good time to be casting a mighty blow against capitalism, now must be that time when they're even shown day by day. You can't keep up with the hypocrisy of these swines. Well, we're getting back to basics in relation to putting a basic electoral message out, and we're putting it in the London central constituency, up in Birmingham, two constituents in Scotland. Millions of people are going to receive our election message. We're putting out a million copies, over a million copies, of our election manifesto this June. It's the biggest electoral effort that revolutionary socialists have ever gone in for in this country. We're bringing out the socialist standard. Don't just buy one socialist standard day. Take half a dozen. Do what Owen did. Learn something from the novel. Give them away. Half a dozen will only cost you about a fiver. Or sell them. So take something practical out of the novel. But the most practical thing of all is the novel teaches the benefits of discussion. And our meetings every Wednesday at 8 o'clock, and sometimes we sit there above that pub, Wednesday after Wednesday, talking to ourselves and wondering if anyone's ever gonna come and bloody talk to us. We feel very much like Owen. Not quite as bad as our comrades in Belfast, who tell us how sometimes they sit in their meeting place and they hear footsteps on the stairs and they don't know whether it's going to be a person who's going to become a future comrade or someone who's going to shoot them through the head. Join with us. Get involved. So we're there every Wednesday night at 8 o'clock. If you don't live in this area, we can tell you your local branch. We are a political party. We are doing something. We are saying something. If you want to oppose us, oppose us. But don't go away from this meeting and decide to do nothing. Because that's what the ragged trouser philanthropists in the end did. If you do nothing, you're doing something. You're supporting capitalism. Now, for Christ's sake, don't do that. Now, I'll take a final question over that.
Oh, it wasn't a question, really. There was a contributor from the back there who mentioned that conditions could be getting so bad, the workers feel more and more repressed. Eventually, this could lead to some kind of an insurrection. Am I right in thinking that there was no talk of insurrection in the rabbit trouser philanthropists? And it's an idea which the Socialist Party came to terms with. At its formation, that insurrection in any circumstances cannot lead to liberation or socialism, because of the necessary nature of socialism requiring the understanding that the majority of people need knowledge of why they're setting up what they're setting up and practical plans for sustaining such an alternative society without wages, without all the oppressive features. I don't know if this is what the contributor meant by insurrection, because the Socialist Party anyway says that a new society will only be established on the basis of understanding via the ballot box. That's the way to change, democratically. And so that's the reason they opposed SWPs and a lot of other so-called working class organisations who believe in insurrection. It's outdated. Do you agree?
I do agree. The power of the rifle will be met with the power of the machine gun from the state. If you own a machine gun and you're on the barricades, the power that you think you have with the machine gun will be met with a howitzer, an anti-personnel rocket. If you've got one of those, they'll bomb you from the air. And if you've got an aeroplane with bombs, they'll shoot you down with their exocets and all the rest of their modern technology. That kind of path is doomed to failure because you don't control the state machine. Whereas the power of knowledge and how to use it and what to do with it is something that they can't shoot down. When a sufficient number of people have said to them, piss off, you're an ineffective, stupid anachronism. Now, there's about 30, 40, 50,000 of you in the whole world that own and control everything, and we're the vast majority, and you're finished. And you take over all the necessary machinery and the power in order to abolish that political, that state power. When that kind of uprising, which says, we've seen through you, you no longer can control, and we're talking about majorities in all walks of life. Majority socialist in the world of the media, majority in the world of transport, majority in the world of production. And at every one of those facets of society, we are the majority.
We run it for them. We make the decisions. We solve their problems. We run about like glass fireflies when they're in a panic to help them out. When we stop doing that and run about like glass flies for socialism, then they can be pushed into the footnote of history. So socialism is not only the way out and the only possible alternative, but it's the only concept which will leave them standing in their tracks totally helpless, totally ineffective, and bring to an end their ability to convince the majority that we have no power and there's nothing we can do about it. Once we've seen through that, and the majority have demonstrated they've seen through that, the world is our oyster. It all begins there. Capitalism comes to an end. Socialism starts on the road to expansion, development, and success. I mean, it sounds, in some people's ears, too simple for words, and therefore impractical. But it's the most practical thing. And the more you think about it, the more you realise that they have no power, no control, no ownership, no overall power of disposition that we do not give them. We give it to them. When we take it away, they dissolve in the night, like awful ghouls, shadows, ghosts that once disturbed our sleep, like nightmares. And that's it.